welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 4th of May 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm afraid I don't have my co-host Max Musson with me today, so it will just be myself. We've got a couple of news stories to look at, and we'll also get into the third and final part of our presentation on Edward I. Just before we get into all of that, listeners may have seen that there were some changes to the website over the weekend. I'm trying to make some improvements. I'm trying to get the sections to work correctly. So when people click on the view more, they actually get taken to the correct section of the site. It seems to be malfunctioning for a while now. It's been malfunctioning, and hopefully I'll be able to get that fixed in time for when this podcast is published on Monday afternoon anyway. Well, also over the weekend, or just before the weekend actually, we saw David Icke get banned from YouTube. And this was carried out by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. And this is really quite shocking. I mean, I don't go along with David Icke's conspiracy theories, but they're quite harmless. He's certainly not a hater or anything like that. And what this does is it shows us how the censorship has continued to expand. I mean, first off, it began with Andrew Anglin and Daily Stormer. Then it moved to Richard Spencer. And then it moved to InfoWars and Alex Jones, Paul Joseph Watson. And now we see it moving to David Icke. It's just continuously creeping further and further towards the centre with more and more ludicrous explanations for it. I mean, this was the Centre for Countering Digital Hate. How on earth could you describe David Icke as being a hater? Who is it that David Icke supposedly hates? He preaches a message of peace and love to all races, all peoples, all castes, all classes. And yet, just on the word of this Centre for Countering Digital Hate, YouTube banned the guy. And he had just under 1 million subscribers. Think about that. Almost a million people chose to watch David Icke. He was actually the 726th most watched YouTuber in the whole of Great Britain. And this is a very, very popular YouTube channel that has been pulled down. And they're saying that this is because he was giving out information that's different to the World Health Organization, specifically referring to his conspiracy theory about 5G masks causing the coronavirus. And basically, he's putting that information out there, and you can investigate it for yourself and make your own mind up. The whole point of a democracy is that you get to hear everybody's voice. Everybody has a representation. You can hear what people say. We have laws. We have free speech laws that are supposed to guarantee us the right to put our ideas out there. And they're supposed to be able to cross borders, and nobody is supposed to get in the way of that. And yet, since the introduction of these race laws into Britain, there's been this continuous creep to censor what people say. And that's made its way onto the internet. The internet used to be very, very democratic before Donald Trump got elected. The algorithms were that the most popular sites would get bumped to the top of the search results, whether that was on YouTube, whether that was on Google. You used to be able to see all sorts of documentaries on YouTube. And you could make up your mind which ones were believable and which ones were badly researched and obviously had some kind of agenda. Now, this new censorship by YouTube, which the excuse they're using for is that he was giving out information that contradicts the information from the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization has been proved wrong on very, very important points. They were wrong when they said that coronavirus couldn't be passed from human to human. They were wrong when they said that the rest of the world shouldn't be isolating Wuhan when China was isolating Wuhan. they've been seriously wrong and caused multiple deaths. And people were saying at the time, they were saying, we should be isolating China. People were saying, this virus is airborne. It is contractable from human to human. And whistleblowers were pointing this out. And if YouTube's censorship had been in place back then, all of those people that were saying the correct thing would have been censored. They would have been silenced. And now they're using this excuse of going against community guidelines to ban David Icke. And this Center for Countering Digital Hate, they collected 800 signatures. That's all. 800 signatures is all they collected. And they sent a letter with these signatures to YouTube. And YouTube then banned a channel with just under 1 million subscribers. He just had 137,000 new subscribers just in the last 30 days. Thankfully, there has been a letter from Big Brother Watch that's been sent to YouTube that is rather alarmed at all this censorship. But this excuse of whatever the government doesn't like, whatever the establishment doesn't like, whatever the minorities don't like, we'll just call that hate, and that will be a good enough excuse to get it removed, is really alarming. This organization, the CCDH, said that videos of Mr. Icke discussing conspiracy theories had been viewed about 30 million times across social media. We commend YouTube on bowing to pressure and taking action on David Icke's channel, said CCDH's chief executive, Imran Ahmed. However, there remains a network of channels and shadowy amplifiers who promote Mr. Icke's content and need to be removed. And this CCDH is now urging Twitter and Facebook's Instagram to take a similar action and just ban David Icke. Facebook have done the same. They have removed him. But what is David Icke talking about 5G and the harm that 5G can cause people? What has that got to do with digital hate? What has that got to do with hate speech? Is it now hate speech to be concerned about the effects of 5G and radio waves? This is absolutely ludicrous. I really hope that David Icke's fans, that million subscribers, I hope they really make a big fuss about this. I should imagine that the comments in the mainstream comment sections will be supportive of David Icke. They were when YouTube banned the interview that he did. There was lots and lots of pro-David Icke comments. You don't have to agree with what he says, but you do have to stand up for the right of the man to be able to say it, especially if you believe we live in a democracy. And this just proves that all these democratic ideals, they're all fake. They just spout them to try and give some legitimacy to the form of government that we have, but it's no different to the form of government that they have in China, where they censor people, or in North Korea, where they censor people. But they're honest about it. They are honest about the reasons why they do it, because it's critical of the establishment. Over here, we come up with this nebulous phrase, hate. It's hate speech. David Icke hates these 5G towers, so we must be concerned about the feelings of the 5G towers, and we must ban David Icke. It's like the Universal Compact on Migration that the European countries have signed up to, the United Nations Compact on Migration, which says that all the countries that signed up to it will make it into hate speech to criticise immigration. So to criticise a government policy, they're going to make into hate speech. It's constantly expanding. It begins with, oh, we've got to be careful about the feelings of the minorities, to, oh, you can't criticise a government policy. What has the government policy got to do with the feelings of minorities? What has 5G towers got to do with feelings of anybody, really? This is insane that they've banned him like this. It's good for us, because it just shows that everything that we say is true, that you can't criticise the establishment, you can't criticise policy, you can't come out with any ideas that are different to the mainstream narrative nowadays, without there being calls for censorship. And of course, who is the chief executive? Imran Ahmed. So it's a Muslim that's getting David Icke banned. And I can't recall David Icke being particularly critical of Muslims any more than he's critical of everything else. As I say, he preaches a real peace and love message, David Icke does. This is good for us, but obviously not good for David Icke, and it confirms everything that we've been saying about censorship and the way that if you allow censorship for one, then it will creep and it will expand, and eventually you'll end up with YouTube just showing mainstream sources, which is pretty much where it's got to now. It's all mainstream sources on there, and the whole point of it was that you were supposed to be able to film yourself and put your own views out there and communicate with other people, which is what the Human Rights Act enshrined in law, that we would be able to communicate across borders and no government would put restrictions on information. And of course, it's all just nice words, isn't it? There's no actual meaning behind it. They just add this clause of, well, if we decide it's hurting the feelings of somebody, then we can't have that. And it's really all just about their anti-white policies and covering those up and preventing people being critical of them. And with this new action taken by Facebook and YouTube to silence people that are critical of WHO policy, this is going to be really dangerous. Really dangerous. I mean, the WHO have said that we shouldn't be wearing masks. And now they seem to have changed that and said, well, we should be wearing masks. In America, they've said, when you go out, you should be wearing masks. Over here in Britain, in England, they've been telling us all this time, masks won't protect you from the coronavirus. It's quite obvious that masks will protect you from the coronavirus. Otherwise, you wouldn't see the NHS workers wearing them, would you? And now we've got Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland is telling the Scots that they need to wear masks on public transport, something that they should have said months back here in England, rather than allowing those London Underground drivers and bus drivers and allowing them to just die. More than 10 of them died. All they had to do was advise them that they should be wearing an FFP3 mask routinely while they're driving, and they might still be here. But they're still not telling us the truth about this. And I dare say, if you were to point that out on YouTube, they could say that you're giving out alternative information and you need to be censored. It's hate speech saying that people should be wearing masks. We've actually got an instance now of the UK Border Force demanding that they should be able to wear masks, and they've been told that they're not even allowed to wear their own masks at work, despite two officers having already died of the coronavirus. Border Force staff have claimed that if they are carrying out passport and customs checks, dealing with a high number of members of the public, they are not allowed to wear personal protection equipment. Reportedly, only staff who are dealing with those suspected of having the Chinese virus or when processing illegal aliens may protect themselves. Well, how are you going to know if somebody's got the virus or not? We've been told that the whole country has been put into lockdown because we have to assume that everybody could have the virus, which means that you should be wearing a mask all the time when you're dealing with the public. Why can't the Border Force staff purchase their own mask? Why can't they wear a mask that they have purchased themselves to protect themselves? The Immigration Services Union wrote to its members on April the 25th, saying, "We know many of you feel strongly that you should be able to wear face masks routinely at work in order to protect yourself and others from COVID-19 infections. We are therefore very worried that Border Force are preventing you from wearing your own face masks at work and in places, threatening you with disciplinary action if you do try to wear a mask." Think about that. They're being threatened with the sack if they try to protect themselves. "To say the least, this seems to us an aggressive and unreasonable attitude to take towards staff with genuine welfare concerns." And maybe this is down to the government. They want to save all these FFP3 masks for the NHS, and they want to pretend that the general public don't need to wear a mask. So they're coming down heavy on people that are wearing masks, that are trying to protect themselves. Everything about the way that they have responded to this coronavirus is just totally insane. It's just incompetence on top of incompetence from start to finish. And with this, they're deliberately putting people in harm's way. People, sensible people that have actually paid out their own money to buy masks to protect themselves, and they're being told that they're going to get the sack if they wear them. The allegations came after a UK Border Force officer working at Heathrow Airport spoke to the media, saying that he and his colleagues were unable to do their job protecting the border because there are no tests for arrivals. This was despite planes still coming in from virus hotspots China, Iran, and Italy. And the people at the borders have been saying this for months now. They've been saying, why on earth have we still got people coming in into the country that aren't being quarantined? We shouldn't have people coming in anyway, but if we have got people coming in, why are they not being taken off and quarantined for 2 weeks? And the government are saying, well, we're just advising people that if they don't feel well, they should stay in. But if you're coming to another country and you're coming as a tourist, you're not just going to go stay in for the first 2 weeks that you actually get to the country. They've got no legal force here at all to ensure that people quarantine themselves. While the actual British public are all having to stay in, these people that have just arrived, there's nothing to force them to. The source, whose identity was not revealed, as he feared to lose his job, added that he and his colleagues raised concerns about flights from China as early as December 2019, but that their reports were just brushed off by management. So it's not like people haven't been raising the alarm. It's not like people haven't been saying, this is really dangerous, we need to close the borders. People have been saying that for months now. And the government still haven't done that. Two UK Border Force staff who had worked at the London airport have now died from the Chinese coronavirus. And these officials have been told that they don't need to wear masks. The countries where the governments have told people to wear masks are all countries that have managed to deal with this threat. They've managed to get the threat under control. They've gone back to finding out the people that have got the virus and isolating them and quarantining them, and they've been able to get their economies going again. The countries which haven't, Britain and America, are in the worst state. I mean, Britain is fast catching up with Italy as being the country with the most deaths and the worst outbreak of this. And to think, all of this could have been avoided if they had just isolated China. And the big drive now is to try and blame China for this and say, well, China didn't say that other countries should stop flying in to China. China shouldn't have to say, don't fly into Wuhan, when they themselves have isolated Wuhan entirely and have welded all the apartment buildings shut and dug up all the roads. They shouldn't have to say, by the way, it might be a good idea if you stop flying in and out of Wuhan, especially taking people with the disease back to your own country. I mean, this has actually been put to representatives of the British government, and they've said, oh yes, well, we had to fly these people back so they could be with their families. So their right to be with their family, their human rights, overrides everybody else's right not to catch this disease. They should have been left there in China for the Chinese authorities to deal with in the hospitals over there if their conditions had worsened. Bringing them back into Britain, bringing them back into Europe and America has just spread this virus all around the world. There is only one way that it can spread, and that is through human contact, human to human contact. You have to stop that contact in order to prevent it from spreading. It's just incredible. I mean, it's predictable. We all know how incompetent our governments are. It was predictable that they would behave like this. But to then come out with these ideas that anyone that contradicts the World Health Organization, anyone that suggests that doing what the World Health Organization advises might not actually be the sensible thing, to say that people should now be censored for that, again, it's just insane. I'm just thankful that at RadioAlbion.com, we've never relied on platforms like Facebook or Twitter. We set up our own platform so that we couldn't be censored, so that we could stick within the law and speak to our own people. And groups like this Centre for Countering Digital Hate, there's nobody they can go to put pressure on to try and ban us. What are they going to do? Ban us from our own website? Well, that's the news that I really wanted to get into today. There hasn't really been that much else happening in Britain. Boris Johnson has given birth to baby Boris, number 6, with a huge head of blonde hair. It's quite incredible. The baby even appears to have sideburns. I don't think I've ever seen such a hairy baby. But congratulations to him for that. And we're told now that the primary schools will be opening up in June. And I think we will probably have most of these restrictions lifted by the end of June. They'll probably start with the primary schools, maybe even before then, maybe at the end of May, three weeks from now, we will probably see things lifting. But obviously, because of that, there really isn't that much news to bring you from what's happening in Britain. Obviously, this program is specifically to deal with what's happening in Britain. So thankfully, we do have the continuation of the presentation on Edward I to get into. And just before I get into that, maybe it's worth me pointing out that the reason for going into British history and understanding history from our own point of view, because since the Second World War, the history that we have been taught has not been from our point of view. It's been very, very critical of ourselves, and it's primarily there to promote diversity and to promote white guilt. And the reason for that is because we have allowed our governments, we've allowed our establishment to gradually be taken over by our own traitors and by other peoples who are obviously advocating for their own interests rather than advocating for our interests. And some people might listen to Radio Albion. I mean, we've had people listen to Radio Albion, and we've been criticized for not criticizing the Jews enough or not criticizing the minorities enough. And the reason why we don't go for that, the reason why we don't just blame the Jews for everything, or just blame blacks for everything, or just blame Muslims for everything, is because none of those people would be here if we hadn't allowed them in the first place. And none of those people would have the influence that they do if we hadn't given them that influence. And in order to find that out, you have to go back into history to discover that. We're talking here about Edward I. Well, he expelled the Jews. But then when we get to the 16th, 17th century, and we get to Oliver Cromwell, we backed Oliver Cromwell, who had funding from Dutch Jews, and we backed Oliver Cromwell, and we helped Oliver Cromwell to depose and execute our king Charles I. Once he had executed the king, he set up a paleo-Bolshevik regime, where he did away with Christmas, and he did away with Easter, did away with all the things that the British people liked. He had a very Puritan view on things, and went into Ireland and caused trouble in Ireland, went into Wales, killed lots of people in Wales, and tried to do away with the British system of monarchy, basically, which lasted for about 10 years. Cromwell was still around, and his representatives, and he was advocating for the Jews to come back into Britain. And this was around about the time of Puritanism and Protestantism, and we hadn't had Jews in the country for 500 years. We had had merry old England. And the Protestants at the time thought, the reason why the Jews weren't Christian is because they hadn't actually seen Christianity done properly. And now that we'd had the Reformation and the Protestants have split away from the Catholics, they were very, very zealous, these Protestant Christians. And they thought, well, if only the Jews could see how we live now in England, it's so wonderful, it's so perfect, it's a kingdom of heaven on earth, it's Jerusalem in England. If only the Jews could see that, then they would become Christian and they would be like us. So this was the mentality that our people had. They ignored what they had been told. They ignored the history. They ignored the fact that Edward I was a very good king, and he wouldn't have expelled the Jews without a good reason. And as we learned, the reason was that they were unable to do anything else but usury. They had 15 years to try to learn other trades. They were given all the help in the world to try and learn other trades, productive trades, and they insisted on breaking the law and using usury against us. So that's why they were expelled. And the Protestants ignored that. They ignored that. And when the representatives of the Jews in Holland came to Britain and said, let us back in again. We will make lots of money for you. They said, look at the money that we've made for the Dutch India Company. If you let us come over here into England, we'll make lots of money for you. And King William of Orange was installed as the king, who was a Dutch king. And the first thing he did was allow the Jews back in to England, and he gave them the tender for the Bank of England. And they run the Bank of England ever since then. But the only reason they were able to get back into the country is because we supported Cromwell in his revolution. We supported Cromwell, who killed the king. And the result of that was that the Jews came back into the country and they were given the Bank of England with which to set up their usury system. Far worse than it ever was under Edward I, when Edward I ran the banks and the Jews just had little money lending businesses. But it doesn't stop there. The Jews didn't actually have civil rights. They couldn't have a say in how the government was run. They couldn't have a say in the laws that were made. Until, that is, we gave them civil rights. Who was it that gave them civil rights? It was us that gave them civil rights. Then the Jews demanded that the oaths be changed in Parliament so that they could join Parliament. They demanded that the oath be changed so that instead of promoting Christian law and Christian values, it be changed to allow the Jews in. And we allowed that to happen. We voted for that to happen. Our representatives voted for that to happen. And the Jews came into government. And ever since then, we've had more and more of a Jewish influence. But all of it was only able to happen because we allowed it to happen in the first place. And you could say that when William the Conqueror came over to Britain, he brought Jews with him. And that was the first time that we had Jews in Britain. He brought these Jews with him and he wanted them to collect taxes, basically. And they set up their usury businesses, and by the time we get to 1290, Edward I expels them because of their bad behaviour. And you could say that the British people, they weren't responsible for that. It was William the Conqueror that was responsible for that. But that was 1,000 years ago. And since then, we are the ones that invited them back. We're the ones that changed the law. We're the ones that changed the laws to allow immigration. Our representatives in Parliament changed impinged upon the free speech laws with the race acts. But you wouldn't know that unless you actually look back into history. That's one of the reasons why it's important to know our history and the history of the minorities. And the other reason is to inspire us and to give us an understanding of the greatness of our ancestors, and to encourage us to believe in ourselves and to try and be the best people that we can be in order to honour our ancestors. So that's the reason why we don't just criticise minorities here, and that's also the reason why we look at history. So let's continue now with this presentation on Edward I. We'll have a little recap first, and last week we talked about Edward and how he emulated King Arthur, how he built the round table that he did, which is now hanging in Westminster. And we got to where the King of Scotland died, and he died without an heir. And they all came to London, and Edward I looked into the records, and he discovered that Balliol should be made king. And he also discovered that the King of Scotland should pay fealty to the King of England and should come and take his place in Parliament. And Balliol made his oath to do that, and the Lords, they all made their oaths to do that. And then they rebelled, just like the Welsh did, and they started burning down the English holdings. So Edward went to war against them. He took the Stone of Destiny that we talked about in great detail. And then he freed them again because they promised that they would obey the King of England. They took their oath again. And then they chose William Wallace as the king, as their king. And they allied with France against England. And then King Edward married the King of France's daughter. So France stopped being allied to Scotland, and William Wallace was captured, and he was executed, and the Lords all swore an oath again. And we also talked about how William Wallace was actually executed, how he was hanged, drawn, his head smitten off, his bowels taken out and burned, his body quartered, and sent to the chief towns of Scotland with his head set upon a spear on London Bridge, that the Scots might have it in mind should they ever take it into their heads to make their own lord again. And I'm repeating that bit because we've talked before about the executions in the first episode, and I thought that hanged, drawn, and quartered meant that the drawn bit meant that they were stretched upon a table. And Max was saying that the drawn bit is that their bowels were taken out. But we see here that actually there was hanged, drawn, head smitten off, and bowels taken out and burned, and the body quartered. So obviously the bowels being taken out and burned is different to actually being drawn. And if you look into hanged, drawn, and quartered, you find that it's actually them being dragged to the gallows. The use of the word drawn, as in to draw, has caused a degree of confusion. One of the Oxford English Dictionary's definitions of draw is to draw out the viscera or intestines of, to disembowel a fowl, etc., before cooking, a traitor or other criminal, after hanging. But this is followed by, in many cases of executions, it is uncertain whether this, or to drag a criminal at a horse's tail or on a hurdle or the like to the place of execution, formerly a legal punishment of high treason, is meant. The presumption is that where drawn is mentioned after hanged, the sense is as here. The Welsh Prince Dafydd ap Gruffydd, that was the Welsh Prince David that we talked about, became the first nobleman in England to be hanged, drawn, and quartered after he turned against the king and proclaimed himself Prince of Wales and Lord of Snowdon. Dafydd's rebellion infuriated Edward I so much that he demanded a novel punishment. Therefore, following his capture and trial in 1283 for his betrayal, he was drawn by horse to his place of execution. For killing English nobles, he was hanged alive. For killing those nobles at Easter, he was eviscerated and his entrails burned. For conspiring to kill the king in various parts of the realm, his body was quartered and the parts sent across the country. His head was placed on top of the Tower of London. A similar fate was suffered by the Scottish leader, Sir William Wallace. Captured and tried in 1305, he was forced to wear a crown of laurel leaves and was drawn to Smithfield, where he was hanged and beheaded. His entrails were then burned and his corpse quartered. His head was set on London Bridge and the quarters sent to Newcastle, Berwick, Stirling, and Perth. And this actually then, after that, it became the punishment for treason, was to do all this to the traitor. And they actually did it to Oliver Cromwell after he was dead. After he was dead, they dug his corpse up so that they could do this to him because he was such a traitor. And the dragging bit where they would draw the person to the gallows, they actually put them on a hurdle, because there was a difficulty that dragging the person to the gallows would actually kill them. And the point of this was so that they would be kept alive, they would be dragged behind the horse, still alive, they would be hanged a little bit, still alive, and then they would have their bowels pulled out while they were still alive, then they would be quartered while they were still alive, and then finally they would have their head cut off. And there are instances of our history of the person being executed shouting things out as they saw parts of them lopped off. I mean, it's pretty barbaric, but you have to think that this was to prevent people from engaging in treason, which was the worst crime you could possibly do was treason against the king. And you think that's what Oliver Cromwell did. That's what he did. Regicide. And when you think about that, you think, well, maybe actually it's not that unjust that we have had such bad royalty since. And we had royalty that allowed the Jews in to take over our banks. Is that not a just punishment for us going along with killing our king, the worst possible crime there could be? Is there justice in that? I don't know. But this punishment, hanged, drawn and quartered, it was thought up by King Edward. And as we talked about before, he was such a good man, he was such a charitable, merciful man, that this sort of balanced it out, doesn't it? It balances it out that he was very harsh to the people that broke the law, but very good to those that didn't break the law. So William Wallace, he's done away with. But then Robert the Bruce returns, and he makes himself king, and he murders Sir John Comyn and his brother in the Grey Friars Church that we talked about last week. And Sir John Comyn was loyal to the King of England, and Wikipedia makes him out to be a rival for the throne of Scotland, which is an outright lie. And when King Edward heard of this mischief, he swore that he would avenge Sir John, and he regretted being so lenient with the Scots, saying that all the traitors of Scotland should have been hanged and drawn when he had them in the Tower, rather than being ransomed. And I've forgotten how many times now these Scots have made oaths, that sworn oaths to the King of England, and then broken them. And I mean, it really does sort of give you the reasons why in the hymn God Save the King, it has a line, rebellious Scots to crush. Because this was rebellion, and this was oath breaking, and this was treason. These were serious crimes that they were guilty of. And we've got one final battle now that happened. The king summoned all his loyal knights from England and Wales and amassed a huge army to storm Scotland. The armies met at St. John's Town in Scotland, and 7,000 Scots were slaughtered. I mean, that is a huge battle. And think that in the days when they had these battles, this was still the age of chivalry. They would stop and at tea time, and they would stop on a Sunday. They would stop for mass. The people, the knights of the hospital, they would go out there to rescue them. Clergy couldn't be attacked. This is one of the reasons why this crime that took place in the church was such an affront to the British people, because the law that you get sanctuary in a church, and you can't be attacked in a church, you can't be dragged out by the police or a sheriff or anything like that, that goes all the way back to Druidic times, when if you could get to a stone circle, no violence could take place in that either. And you've got very, very long tradition here that Robert the Bruce broke by murdering Sir John Comyn in the church. When Bruce saw the mischief, he began to flee and tried to hide, that no man could find him. But his earls were found and were made to pay. Sir Simon Frizzle tried to bribe his way out of being captured, but the king's archer said, "Not for all the gold in England would I do out without the commandment of King Edward." and he took him to the king. But the king refused to even set eyes upon him, and had him sent straight to London. So this is the thing, that this is the point that they're making here. These Scots had broken their oaths, and everybody else was loyal to the king, and even the Scottish peasants, they were loyal to the king. It was their establishment that was causing this trouble. On Our Lady's Eve, he was hanged and drawn, with his head smitten off, and hanged again with chains on a gallows, and his head set on a spear at London Bridge. At Christmastide, his body was burned, because every night men were seeing devils tormenting the body on the gallows. And the Chronicle has quite a descriptive piece there, describing all these horrific visions that the people of London were seeing, because this man was so evil, what he did, helping to murder Sir John Comyn in the church. And of course, you're not told anything about that in Braveheart. You're not told that these were murderers, and they weren't actually liked by the peasants, and that King Edward was the good guy. They make King Edward out to be a horrible person in the Braveheart movie. And in that battle was taken the Bishop of Glasgow, the Bishop of St. Andrews, and the Abbot of Scone, all armed with weapons like men of arms, false traitors and false prelates, breaking their oaths to the king and to the church. And again, that's a law that goes all the way back to Druidic times, that clergy and priests could not take part in battle. And yet what you had here, you had clergy and priests that were taking part in battle. So what you would have, you would have the English that would see that this was a bishop, this was a priest, and they wouldn't attack him. And the priest would then pull out a sword or pull out a club and he would attack the Englishman. And this is such dishonourable behaviour. That's why it says here that they were breaking their oaths to the king and to the church. The oath to the king was their loyalty, and the oath to the church was that they wouldn't pick up weapons. They were brought before the king, who sent them to Rome for the Pope to deal with and to do to them as he saw fit. So you would think that he would do the same as he had done to the Scottish lords and have them hanged and drawn and all the rest of it. But he still sent them to Rome for the Pope to deal with, because they were under the Pope's authority. They were seen as separate in some way, even though they were British, they were British churchmen. They were, their authority above them was the Pope. The secular authority was the king, and the spiritual authority was the Pope. So John of Ateles tried to hide in a church, but he was brought to the king, where he claimed kindred to King Edward. So he claimed that he was a relative to King Edward. So he was hanged, his head smitten off, and his body burned to ashes, but he was not drawn, due to the prayer of Queen Margaret. So Queen Margaret had confirmed that Sir John of Ateles was actually related. So he didn't get so many punishments as the rest. And Robert the Bruce was much hated in Scotland after this, and was forced to flee to Norway. Once he knew that he had left, King Edward cried peace throughout Scotland, but before he could get back to England, he died of a malady in the Burg of Sand in the March of Scotland. So he pretty much died on the battlefield. He had the victory. He was able to cry peace throughout the land, and that was the wording that they had. If you committed a crime, you were breaking the king's peace. And the king guaranteed that people could travel the highways without any harm to their person. So this is why it was seen as a crime against the king. A crime against anybody was taken as a crime against the king, because it was breaking the peace of the land. And I like the way that the Chronicle describes it, as that he cried peace throughout the land. And it's just a shame that he died there, but at least he saw victory before he did actually die. And the fact that he died in Scotland is also remarked upon by Merlin hundreds of years before. Now, Merlin was a prophet. He was a soothsayer. He was a wise man. He was at Arthur's court, King Arthur. And there were actually two King Arthurs. There was a King Arthur in Roman times who fought the Romans. And there was a King Arthur in Saxon times who fought the Saxons. And at the time when King Arthur was fighting the Saxons, we actually find a 30-year gap in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, because obviously Arthur defeated them and drove them from the country. And I think it was the second King Arthur, during the Saxon times that actually had Merlin there. And I'll just read you a bit of a description about Merlin before we look into what the Chronicle says about his prophecies. The fame, however, of Merlin as an historical character rests neither upon romance nor tradition, but upon his prognostications and predictions, which certainly had a great and decisive effect in sustaining the spirit of the Britons to oppose the Saxon invaders. From Norman times unto the Stuarts, Merlin's prophecies were consulted on the accession of every new sovereign to the English throne, as naturally as we consult an almanac to know when there is a new moon. There are several very fine black-letter copies in the Bodleian Library, Oxford, of Merlin's prophecies. And the Chronicle has some of them in there, and it makes reference to these prophecies when it talks about the various kings that we had. And this is what the Chronicle has to say about Merlin's prophecy of Edward. Merlin prophesied of Edward, calling him a dragon, the second king of the last of the kings to reign in England, who shall be tempered with mercy and also with sternness that will keep England from cold and from heat. And that's certainly very true. He was very merciful, and he also was very harsh against his enemies and the enemies of the country, really. And he was a nationalist. I mean, he wanted to see the British people come together as British people. He wanted them to stay with their sovereign nations. He wanted the princes to rule in Wales. He wanted the princes to rule in Scotland. But he wanted them to come to London, to the Parliament there, to rule the country and advise him on what was the best thing to do. And he wanted to have a sense of kinship and bring these different peoples together. You think about it, at this time you had the Picts and the Irish that became the Scots. You had the Britons that had become the Welsh, and you had the Anglo-Saxons who had been conquered by the Normans, plus you had Danes here as well. And of course, they're all white Nordic peoples, but they all had slightly different cultures. So he was trying to pull everyone together and get everybody working together, because he knew that that would lead to the success of the country. And of course, after this time, after Edward, we actually had Merry England, as I was saying, for a few hundred years there, when we had no usury in the country at all, and it was just the king that ran the London Mint. Continuing with this prophecy here, he will open his mouth towards Wales, and he will set his foot upon Wick, and will fight with Wales, who will do much harm to his seed. So the Welsh must have done a lot of damage to the English that were fighting there. And note that they also say that Edward here is a dragon. And the dragon doesn't have to be a satanic symbol. In actual fact, if you look back through British history, the king of the country, when the country was facing a threat, an external threat, a foreign threat, the kings would all come together under one main king, who would be called the Pendragon, and he would be like the war general. And you wanted a dragon to defend you. You wanted something fierce, a fierce mythical creature to be defending you against your enemies. And of course, there was another legend of Merlin seeing a white dragon and a red dragon that were fighting underneath Vortigern's tower, King Vortigern. And Merlin was called to say what this actually meant. And he said that the white dragon is the Saxons and the red dragon is the Welsh, and the white dragon will chase off the Welsh, and he will actually defeat the Welsh, which is what basically happened. And that's probably the most famous prophecy that Merlin actually made. But as I say, he also made all these other prophecies about the forthcoming kings that we were to have. He will make rivers run with blood and with brain, and there shall come a people out of the north, west, during the reign of the dragon, that shall come from an evil greyhound, that the dragon shall crown king, that shall afterwards flee without coming again, for dread of the dragon. And of course, that is what happened. Down from the north, the Scots came, and Edward crowned the Scots. He crowned Robert Bruce king, or Balliol. I mean, we had Robert Bruce, Balliol, and William Wallace. We actually had as king of the Scots. But I think Balliol was the first one, John Balliol, that Edward crowned king. But then he made war against him. Continuing here, that the people that should lead will be forsook by the people of the Greyhound, who will end up fatherless unto a certain time because of it. So what that's talking about there is the English people should have been leading, King Edward should have been leading, but the people of the Greyhound forsook him, the Scots forsook him, and as a result they ended up fatherless unto a certain time because of it. And what that means is that they were disinherited. The same as the Welsh royal line was disinherited by Edward beheading Dyfed and Llewellyn and taking that role or giving that role to his son as the Prince of Wales. The same happened here, that the Scots were disinherited. They weren't allowed to have a king, because each time they had a king, they broke their oath to the King of England and made war against the English. So they were prevented from having a monarchy, but only for a certain time, as it says here, for a certain time. Because as we know, there were Scottish kings that were upon the throne of England. The Stuarts were some of them. The sun will become in his time as red as any blood, in a tokening of the great mortality and death of this people. And that's talking about the Scots. And as I mentioned earlier, there were thousands of them that were actually slaughtered in one of these battles. And the dragon shall nourish a fox that will make war against him, and afterwards this dragon will hold the best body in all the world. So again, what he's talking about there, the fox there is William Wallace, and he was the fox that was eventually killed by Edward. And where it says this dragon will hold the best body in all the world, that's a reference to the height of King Edward, who was huge, six foot two, they reckon he was. That's why he was called Longshanks. And when you think of the size of the early houses that we have in Britain, the doors are about 5 foot six tall. So most of the people are probably only about 5 foot at this time. Possibly because they didn't have enough nutrition to fully expand, to fully grow into their phenotype. But the king obviously would have done. He would have had lots and lots of nutrition. He would have had the ability to grow to a tall size. But beyond that, he was abnormally tall as well. So that's what this reference here is, that the dragon will hold the best body in all the world. When he dies, it shall be in another land, and his own land will be without a good keeper, and men shall weep for his death from the Isle of Sheppey to the Isle of Marseille, where it shall be the common song among a fatherless people living in a wasted land. And he did. He died in Scotland, as we just heard. He was mourned from the Isle of Sheppey to the Isle of Marseille. As we know, Edward had land in Gascoigne. He was also the King of Gascoigne, and he was regularly going over there during his reign. And think, this prophecy was written hundreds of years before Edward's reign. And where it's referring here to the common song among a fatherless people living in a wasted land, that could refer to the Scots, who were made a fatherless people. Or it could be referring to the English. It's probably the Scots, because the Scots were living in a wasted land. They'd had this battle, these big battles with the king. They had lost. So it's probably referring to them. But don't forget, at the start of the prophecy, it says that Edward was the second king of the last of the kings to reign in England, who shall be tempered with mercy and also with sternness. So he's the last of the good kings, is basically what they're saying here, is that Edward I was the last of the real kings to actually reign in England. And it was a few hundred years later that we executed Charles I. And as I say, I would suggest that we haven't deserved to have any good kings after we executed Charles I, who, by all accounts, was very good to the common people. And this is a thread that runs through all of these early kings, is that they were the real champions of the peasants, the real champions of the poor. And they would argue the case of the poor against the nobles. And it was the kings that put a check upon these nobles who wanted to abuse the poor, basically, and make as much as they could possibly make out of them. And if you think back to when we discussed King Alfred, he was all about educating the poor and educating the English and getting rid of judges who couldn't read. And then you can see Edward here as well. He's getting rid of these corrupt judges. He's executing corrupt judges and corrupt sheriffs, and he's getting rid of the Jews and sending them to France because they were mistreating the English people. And as we mentioned, the one Jew actually owned more than the King of England in riches that he had managed to swindle out of the English people with their usury swindle. So Edward was a great man. He was a very good king. And he was thought of as such at the time. These notes that I've got here, they were all written at the time while he was alive. And he was such a good king that he was prophesied by Merlin. It'd be interesting to see how the rest of Merlin's prophecies correspond with the kings that they are talking about. They're all written in Old English, and it's hard to understand. They're talking about boars and various animals that were around in England at the time. As we can see here, they're referring to the Scots as a greyhound and William Wallace as a fox. And the king is referred to as a dragon. And they are recurring motifs in these prophecies. And if we're going to call Alfred the Great, then I would suggest we should call Edward the First, Good King Edward, because he was certainly good. He was certainly good. He was looked up to. He made all these changes to the laws, these positive changes to the laws. He introduced new coinage, got rid of the coin clipping, got rid of usury, made peace throughout the whole country, succeeded in getting the Welsh to come to Parliament and take part in the governing of the whole country. He succeeded in getting the Scots to come down to Parliament and take part in the governing of the whole country. And we were able to live at peace. And we were able to advance and grow in the way that we were supposed to grow, in the way that we are supposed to grow as white people. And that just about brings us to the end of the podcast today. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget, we do require donations to keep the website going. We do have a Bitcoin wallet that you can send us Bitcoin to. I will be back next Monday, hopefully with Max. And until then, I hope you'll have a great week ahead of you.